You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 103 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl champions, Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
And you're back.
I am back after a full week in Portland, Oregon, where the town is abuzz with news that they might get a baseball team.
Wait, there's news that they might get a baseball team?
Yeah, you're not following this story?
Wow!
I mean, maybe I should save this for Mariners High. Maybe we should have some hot takes about this.
There's talk about a this is just like Portlandia.
Yeah, yeah.
Fred Armisen and Kerry Brownstein going to be choosing the players. And
yes.
They're going to be wacky Portlandites.
I hope.
How serious is this baseball talk?
Well, the A's appear to be in some jeopardy of moving from Oakland. And there's been a group that got put together, and over the past week it has been
reported. It features Cliff Robinson. this is every Portlandite I know.
I don't think Uncle Spliffy is part of the group. He's too busy with his weed business.
Okay. That's how he's paying for the baseball team.
Who else do you know?
That's it. We've exhausted it.
You're not even going to throw in Kerry Brownstein after making that joke?
I consider her as being from Olympia.
That's fair. But anyway, within the past week, I believe this was originally reported by friend of the pod, Dwight Janes, on Rip City Radio, that the group that is trying to bring a baseball team into Portland has put in a bid on a like Portland School District building near the Moda Center, near the Rose Garden, where they would build a 32,000-seat stadium.
Really? There's that much space down there to build a baseball stadium in downtown Portland?
I mean, this is on the east side of the river. You wouldn't really consider it downtown Portland,
wow.
Technically.
I mean, that rivalry would be hot.
We need more Seattle-Portland rivalry. Like, I mean, I'd rather bring it back in the NBA. That's yes. My preference.
Yes. I don't want to be cheering for the Blazers. I don't want to be wearing a Blazers shirt right now.
I mean, no one forced you to put on the Blazers shirt. You just did that of your own volition.
But a baseball, like, I would maybe get into baseball if there's something that we could hate Portland about.
Yeah, because that's gotten you so into the soccer right now.
Anyway, it was hard to tell whether this would be either a sad cast or a Portland cast or both. But before then, if you want to be very sad about something that is actually not Portland related,
but is related to Seattle-Portland rivalries that no longer exist. Last week in your pod, you may have noticed in your feed, we dropped a narrative pod, a very different thing, on the 10th anniversary of the last Sonics game at Key Arena, which happened 10 years ago last Friday. You don't remember that game in a weird way, do you?
Not really, no. I remember you coming home and talking. Are we talking about this? Are we getting into it?
I think we can get into it for a second.
Okay.
Since you were not part of the pod.
You could have had me or Kevin Durant talk about it, and for some reason you went with Kevin Durant.
Weird, you know, I stand by that decision.
Can you imagine it'd be like, Pelton Cast co-host Tristan Caracino. I'd be like, I don't remember the game.
That's a wonderful
what it would have been like. I would have fit in really naturally between Earl Watson and Kevin Durant.
But you did not, in fact, attend that game.
No, I mean, it was me and Kevin Calabro have a lot of things in common. But
go to your love of the Blazers.
Yes. Foremost among them is that neither of us thought it was going to be the last game in Seattle.
It seemed at the time, I didn't go into this in great detail, but my anticipation as well was that the city of Seattle was going to win its lawsuit against the ownership group and Clay Bennett, keep the team there for two lame duck years, which would have been miserable. I stand by that take. There's a lot of people that feel that, you know, Greg Nichols should have held the team to the lease and not settled. The team, in my opinion, was gone no matter what happened, and it just would have been two horrible, awkward years like the last few months, except with even with less uncertainty about what was going to happen.
So you're saying you're pro the Nichols decision for that agreement? I mean, you remember he came out and he was like, I think you guys are going to like this one. It's like, no, dude, actually, fuck you. We don't like this one.
I mean,
you just agreed to give away our basketball team.
Pro is too strong here, but I don't think the outcome would have been any different otherwise. So part of the reason that I did find that game memorable, even though I thought it wasn't going to be the Sonic's last game, is because I thought I wasn't going to suffer through those two lame duck seasons. So I thought it was going to be my last game working for
the Sonic's. You had the trucks, the moving trucks already packed.
I was moving to Boulevard Park. I don't know where I was moving to, but yes, I had it in my mind that that was going to be my last game either way.
You were going to quit the Sonics because you worked for the Sonics at the time.
Yes.
And you were going to quit the Sonics no matter what.
That was done with the team. My intent.
Really?
Yeah.
Even if they stayed around, even if they offered you some sort of like, not a front office position, but some sort of like influence within the front office. If they offered you the stats job, you're no longer doing the website. You're doing stats for the Sonics with Sam Presti.
I would have done that, but I was not offered that at the time. So
you weren't willing to work for the team in the same capacity that you are anymore.
Yeah, because like covering the team for the website as they continued to be bad and were on the verge of moving, like that didn't seem super appealing to me.
Yeah, no matter what, that was going to be bad.
Yeah.
I was just so convinced that they were going to stay for those years. I mean, it's so fascinating. Have people asked, what is the judge's name? Marcia Peckman, is that her name?
Yes.
That's kind of amazing that I still remember that 10 years later. But
has anyone asked about what she would have ruled on it?
Yeah. Have people asked her?
Not that I recall seeing. I don't know that she's allowed to say under the terms of the settlement. It's one of those things that, who knows, maybe decades down the line you could figure out.
But third Pelton brother, Marcia Peckman, is what you're saying. That's what you're telling me.
That is exactly.
Get a couple of cans of Rainier Radler in her and we'll see what happens. But I was convinced that the team was going to be here for those 2 years. I didn't really understand why. Unless the deal included some sort of like guarantee return to Seattle basketball. Like if you get an arena done, you will have a team immediately after, which didn't happen. It was just basically a small sum of money and more money if they got a team during a certain time period.
Well, the additional funds, I didn't get into detail on this in the pod, but it was $45 million, which paid off, you know, the bonds that the city of Seattle was still paying on Key Arena renovation at that point. Plus, it would have been an additional $30 million if the state legislature had approved funding for a replacement arena in the next year, and we hadn't gotten a team within the next 5 years, which, of course, we did not. So we basically cost ourselves $30 million by the legislature refusing to act on that.
I guess so. This money is such small potatoes when you're dealing in terms of NBA teams, right?
But it's big potatoes in terms of dealing with the city budget.
So you're saying this money mattered to the city of Seattle?
Yeah.
Why didn't then? I mean, they had so much leverage in the situation. I mean, I can understand that they could have lost the case. That $45 million was being paid either way, though, right?
Yes.
So they basically got zero out of this agreement. They got
the $45 million. No, it was not money that they were going to receive either way. They would have made a lot less money from the Sonics had they played here in those 2 years. They were, I think they were at that point losing money on an annual basis operating Key Arena.
But let's say that Marcia Peckman ruled against the city of Seattle and they broke their lease, right?
They wouldn't have gotten anything.
They would have gotten zero.
Yeah.
She would have just said, it's fine to break your lease.
Yeah.
So they did get $45 million out of it for the city of Seattle. I guess that's something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I think this ended up in there, but talking to PJ Carlissimo, his position was that neither side was confident that they were going to win based on this settlement. And I'd have to talk to legal experts to probably totally break that down, but that seems reasonable to me.
It would be very fascinating to know what she was going to rule, though.
Yes. Oh, I would love to know that.
I mean, it's impossible not to do this like 94 baseball season revisionist history, just like playing it out what would have happened. I mean, the thing is, it's a little bit different, but we're kind of seeing this in Oakland right now with the Raiders.
In terms of their lame duck seasons?
Yeah. I mean, they're moving to Las Vegas, right?
Right.
And they have one more season left in Oakland?
That's my understanding.
So, and they knew before last season that they were moving to Oakland, correct?
Yes.
So they're doing two lame duck seasons.
Yes.
And nothing's changed.
But the Sonics wouldn't have had Marshawn Lynch on the roster.
I mean, that should have saved them for Oakland. I mean, it would have been fun to have seen the maturation of Kevin Durant. Maybe it would have made it sadder, though.
Yeah.
Maybe we were lucky then.
In the timeline as it actually played out, the third year was the year that in Oklahoma City, they made the playoffs for the first time and took the Lakers to 6 games. The Lakers team that went on to win the championship that year and was the defending champs at the time. So, yeah, it was obvious at that point that they were going to be real good real soon.
Great. So we could have seen both we could have seen, we did see the first year of Kevin Durant, and we could have seen the first 3 years of Kevin Durant, the first 2 years of Russell Westbrook, and the first year of James Harden.
If everything had played out exactly the same, yes. Which,
by the way, solid drafts, if you ask me.
You don't say.
But so anyway, this last game, I was just convinced that they were going to stay. My stance was either the team will stay for two more years, or I just don't want to be there to see, to cheer on their last game, which I probably regret 10 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember you and maybe our mom, because our mom went to the game.
Yes.
Coming back and like talking about the atmosphere there, and then hearing on the podcast that you'd done the Save Our Sonics chant. It's like chilling stuff.
Shout out to my friend and former coworker, Tony Nuxiacamp, who provided the audio for that one. It was very useful.
Well, I focus more on a sad cast now than I am.
Yeah, it definitely started out on a sad cast note. All right, while I was down in Portland last week, I made a stop and picked up some beer for the podcast, and I made a mistake that I am going to regret in much the same way that you regret not going to the Sonics last
night. I feel like the stakes are a little bit smaller.
You don't know how strongly I feel about this issue. So I purchased Rogue Paradise Pucker because I was excited about the paradise part and the ale brewed with natural passion fruit, orange, and guava flavors. And when you first saw this bottle earlier this evening, you had a question for me, which was...
Is this sour? It wasn't even a question. It was a statement. I know what the word pucker means.
Apparently, I do not know. Because only then did I turn the bottle around and realize Paradise Pucker is inspired by the classic Hawaiian juice, which is not sour, infused with passion fruit, orange peels, and guava to create a delightful and refreshing sour ale.
Yes.
Pucker up and embrace the tiki lifestyle.
Pucker up, buddy. Well, so you're in luck. You got that, but you being this big Portland fan over here, always talking about your Blazers. I, for one, got a beer from, let's call it the greater Seattle area.
Is it? Silver City's not anywhere near the Seattle area, is it?
So, but it's from the state of Washington, eh?
It is from there. It's
Silverdale is the greater Seattle area.
I thought Silverdale was the one that was along the Columbia River, like on the border. Am I wrong about that?
You're completely wrong. It's like, okay. It's like across a ferry. It's not that far.
Okay. Well, then I can't
remember. It's just a little bit west. It's like one island west.
Okay, I can't remember.
One body of water west.
We've had beer from a brewery that's like along the Columbia River on the border, but it's obviously not.
I know that you've got Portland on the mind and Oregon on the mind, but this right here is beer from Washington State. And that is the Silver City Brewery Ripe and Juicy Double IPA.
That sounds much better.
So you're going to be consuming most of that, and I'm going to be consuming most of this.
That sounds about right. Okay. I guess let's crack them both open then.
Are you drinking any of that?
I'll give it a shot.
All right. Let's do that first then.
Oh, that's a bit much.
Oh yeah.
Did you forget?
I forgot. I was just started, got into my beer zone. Well, anyway, so first off, a toast, obviously, to 10 years of the Sonics being gone.
Do we want to toast to that?
10 sad
Do we
years.
Want to pour some out for that?
Well, okay. Pouring some out for 10 years of being without the Sonics. A third of my life, we've not had an NBA team.
That's not terrible. I can do that.
The beer?
It's a little more like citrusy sour, like a grapefruit kind of, which I'm okay with. I don't love it, but I'm okay with
it's
it.
It's great. Are you drinking any more of that?
Not more than this. I wanted to propose a toast.
Wait, I wanted to do one more toast before you propose your toast.
Okay.
I wanted to also propose a toast, basically a thank you to everybody who was willing to participate in that podcast. It was Kevin Durant, Damian Wilkins, Earl Watson, PJ Carlesimo, Kevin Calabro.
And Jeff Green, who did not end up making it to the podcast because I screwed up the recording. I tried my best, but I could not make any of his audio
And one work. Last toast to Kevin Durant for spurning the city of Oklahoma and leaving them in this purgatory that they exist in.
Well, there you go.
All right. And their kind words about the city of Seattle.
Yes. The toast I wanted to offer was for someone who we've already talked about as a winner on this podcast. A few weeks ago, when we had our PeltonCast 100 hat giveaway, one of the winners was a mysterious listener, known only as Lion Butt. And let's read the email that we received from him, or her, but presumably him, last week. Greetings. I'm way behind and just listened to episode 101. I heard my name called as the winner of the hashtag PeltonCast 100 Best Listener Award. Thank you. It's a great honor. Your podcast is one of my favorites, right up there with the Paranormal Podcast and Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture. I'm glad you guys made up and came back. Better than ever. Well, you recall, I listened to the Grantland pods, and those were good too, but then they also had a falling out when Bardwell turned heel, which definitely Bardwell turned heel. I tried listening to some of the Seattle ESPN radio shows, and they were as bland and generic as a Costco burger. So thanks for returning for me. So appreciate you for the kind words, Lion Butt.
And really, you know, another toast first to Lion Butt, but then also to us for making up after all those years.
After not talking for over 3 years. I'm glad we buried the hatchet.
Best 3 years of my life. One third of my life without a basketball team. 10% of my life not talking to you.
Should we get into this week's candidate in our search for Seattle's best tacos/burritos
to talk about?
We do.
It feels like it's been so long.
Well, it's been over a week since we went to this location. We had to go last Tuesday before I went on my trip to Portland because I was going to be unable to do it after I return. And so on my birthday, we went to Fogon Cochina Mexicana in Capitol Hill.
So I'd been there before a couple of times, and I would describe myself as not down. It's called Fogon, not Fogon.
I'm pretty sure I have not double checked that.
I'm going to continue pronouncing it Fogon.
Okay.
I not down on it, but not that high on it. I didn't consider it a real contender for best taco or burrito in Seattle. But it's rated very highly on the internet.
It is, and as I mentioned, it had been recommended to me by our cousin Michael and his girlfriend. And so I was excited to go there and try not only the tacos, which we had, but also the mole, since I'm a big mole fan. So we split that and then also three tacos. And the first sign to me that this was going to be a good experience.
I was hoping you'd mention this.
You walk in the door and you see the abuela working and handcrafting tortillas off to the side. And you know you're going to get a good tortilla.
That's what you're going to want to see. And right?
So, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's, you just feel like I'm in good hands here.
Yes, absolutely.
Good experienced hands.
So what did you think about, let's start with the tacos.
I thought that they were the best outside of Tacos Chuquis that we've had so far.
I think I probably agree with you.
Yeah. So we had, do we have all pastor or do we have a mix? I can't remember anymore.
I think they're all pastor.
Yes, it's a very confusing one to say out loud. Yeah, no, that was, and the meat was just solid, but again, the tortilla was what took it over the top.
Just the flavor in the taco. I mean, I like a very minimal taco, but as far as the actual al pastor itself, it was really good. I mean, it exploded with flavor more so than any of the food truck tacos that we've had.
So these are definitely more expensive than your classic street
tacos.
It's
not that big of a difference, though. I see. I have this thing. I was thinking on it, and there's this cognitive issue where you look at it and you're like, if you saw tacos for $3.33 at a food truck, you'd be like, it's a little high.
But I think that'd be substantially high.
I mean, what are they at the food bus? $2.50?
Are they that much?
I think they're $2.50. Maybe it's something else that was $2.50. Maybe it was the Molitas that was $2.50.
I think it was. Yes.
Okay, so it's a little high, but it's not insane. Like, it's just that when you see it as $10, it feels like it's more.
But I would definitely say that you would place this in, if we were doing the same taxonomy as we did for burgers, this would be a cloth napkin taco, even though it's still a street taco.
Yeah, and I don't like the term street taco being applied to tacos at a restaurant. If I'm getting a street taco, I want it to be on the street.
I mean, it describes a certain style that you're getting.
I understand.
But yeah, it was great. They were great.
The tacos were excellent. And no, so the mole.
What did you think of the mole?
I was very let down by the mole.
I started out let down by the mole. I thought my opinion of it improved as it went on, I would say.
It just felt really bland to me. There's not a lot of flavor in the mole.
Yeah, you sometimes get that with mole.
That's not what we were there to judge.
No.
We were there to judge the tacos. We had the mole because it was your birthday.
Yes. And it was something I wanted to try. So I tried it, can say I did it, and probably next time I'm just sticking to the tacos.
Yeah, the tacos are great. I mean, so the thing is, if you look, okay, so what is your rating for Fogon?
I don't even know what scores I've given anymore. I'm going to have to go back and listen to some of these pods. I would say, because if Tacos Chuquis is a 95, this is probably like a 92.
I was going to give it a 92 also.
Okay,
definitively a 92.
We've been very simpatico on it in terms of our ratings, with the notable exception of Tacos Street, where you graded it like a 5, as I recall.
As bad as the Costco burger.
No, it's not as bad as the Costco burger.
No, that was a joke about how bad I rated it.
I know.
I was going to give it a 92 also. The thing is, am I more likely to go there than I am to go to a food truck? I still don't know.
I mean, like, it's in much closer proximity to your office.
It's very close to my office, but it's a lot more work.
Because of the walking there?
No, because you have to sit down and order it.
Because it's a sit-down restaurant, which is part of what makes it a cloth napkin taco.
It's difficult to get to go. Basically, just the experience is going to take that much longer.
Yeah, that's all fair.
You know what I mean? So, like, you're going and sitting. Like, honestly, it should be a much better taco.
Yeah. It has to justify the difficulty.
Both the cost and the difficult. Ordering at a restaurant is difficult.
The time
get investment. Get a fucking counter.
Do you have a taco or burrito that we should do this upcoming week?
So it's supposed to be sunny.
It is. It's very exciting.
Let's say sunny-ish.
No, it's supposed to be full-on sunny, especially early next week.
Full-on sunny?
Yeah.
I'm thinking it might be marination time.
Well, I still was planning to go there in a couple of weeks with friends, so I don't think it's a great... So
you
I'm gonna
can't
that.
Go to marination twice?
I'm not saying I can't do it. I just would be more convenient to do it then.
All right, fine. Fine. All right, so... staring us in the face, I read a list on, I think it was Seattle Eater, of the top tacos in Seattle.
Yes.
And number one on the list was El Camion.
Okay.
Which I've had before, but not a ton of times.
Same. I think I've had it before a Seahawks game, right?
Maybe. I've had their breakfast burritos.
Okay.
And I remember fondly, but not a real competitor, but sitting at number one on that Eater list, I'm thinking I want to get to there as quickly as possible also.
All right. Bring it on, El Camion. El Camion. Should we talk about tacos from a little bit further south? And by this, I do not mean actually in Mexico. The famous Cousin Katie will be on with her Mexican
taco
stories next
week. She doesn't
know
this, but she'll
be
on next week.
Yeah, she'll maybe listen to this at some point on the beach and find out.
Voice of the people, Cousin Katie, and the people have demanded it.
Not in this case. They have not actually demanded it, but they demand more of her in general. Instead, I'm referring to go back to our friends to the south, Portland, having spent the last week there and tried some tacos, although sadly did not get to Tienda Santa Cruz, the recommendation that we received via Instagram. I was like planning to maybe do that today on my way out of town, but then the Blazers lost their first two games of the series, and now I can't be totally certain I'm going back for a game five, so I had to get in one last trip to Screen Door just to be certain there.
Okay. Wait, didn't you go to Screen Door like 2 weeks ago?
I mean... That's
okay.
A long time
You're
ago.
Like, didn't you breathe yesterday?
No. I think it was actually longer than 2 weeks ago that I last went to Screen Door. I don't want to do the calculations, but I hadn't been until
we
this
haven't
trip,
had that Instagram for that long.
No, until this trip, I hadn't been to Portland since like mid-March. It was
didn't
before I went to Spokane.
Instagram that Screen Door, or did you go twice on the trip?
I Instagrammed Screen Door, but this was the IG's been
photo?
Up for a while.
No.
Maybe it was an old photo.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
I don't know.
Did you put hashtag latergram?
Huh. March 22nd. Maybe I'm just misremembering. That was the last time I went there.
That's not that long ago. Okay, it's been about a month. All right, fine.
It's 4 weeks.
All right, fine. You can go a month between having Screen Door. Anyway. Gosh,
no one should have to go a month between having Screen Door. It's cruel and unusual. All right, so the first taco place I hit up when I was in Portland was Uno Mas.
Okay.
And this is also definitely a place that falls under the cloth napkin category. Although it's the location, at least, that I went to. I don't know if they have multiple locations.
In Portland, the cloth napkins are doilies.
The location is near the Timbers Stadium, Providence Park. Mm. And so it's kind of a sports bar slash tacos. And went there on Sunday morning, caught the start of the Bucks-Celtics game. Their game one. The only other person who was in there was a Bucks fan who was intently watching the game. So I was surprised that I was not the person who was most invested in the NBA playoff game that was going on at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning in Portland. That was outstanding. So I went with the breakfast tacos.
Okay.
The chorizo in kind of a verde sauce that was one of the options I had. And then they also had eggs and guacamole as a breakfast taco. And that was stunningly good.
Stunningly
good?
I mean,
not stunningly good.
Okay, I was going to say, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it was more stunning that this is not a thing that exists elsewhere.
I think it exists elsewhere.
I know, okay, that I have not come across.
Okay.
So the upside of this was, of going at breakfast, was I love breakfast tacos.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is I wasn't able to explore like their full menu. They have an incredible array of different types of tacos.
Really?
Like octopus and things like that. I mean, it was... It was quite
would you
plentiful
have eaten the octopus otherwise?
No, I wouldn't have. But I'm just using that to illustrate the number of options that existed for me. But these were a little on the small side for the expense. I think they were the breakfast tacos were $3 each, and I got four of them, but loaded with ingredients. And then in addition to, you know, kind of the main ingredient, both of them had like a heavy layering of sour cream and then a sprinkling of Mexican cheese on the top. It was outstanding.
God, that sounds so good.
Doesn't it?
Ugh.
So I might have to work this into my rotation long
term. Wow. It's going into the... What would you describe as your rotation right now?
Well, Screen Door, Pock Pock, mm-hmm. which I also hit on this trip. Lardo has heavily entered the rotation at this point as Portland's best sandwiches. That was my first stop on this trip.
Same trip for the summer of 2020.
Hmm? Went with the third Pelton brother, Nate Duncan.
Oh, really? Nate Duncan was in town?
Yeah, he was there for the practices for the Hoop Summit, which was last week.
Did you do a little second screen action with him?
Did not do any second screen, sadly. No.
So you and Nate Duncan went to Lardo.
Yeah. Bunk is in heavy rotation, although it's usually because I'm going there at Blazers games mm-hmm. because it's in the Moda Center. And then Pine State Biscuits, which, again, also I...
Yeah, and so Uno Mas is going in the rotation?
I think it is. It's pretty solid. It was more convenient for me when I was like staying downtown on this trip as opposed to if you're on the east side of the river, it wouldn't be as convenient. But it was definitely very solid. So the other place I went for... I didn't have tacos, technically, but did have Mexican food. I went to this food cart, La Jarochita. I've not pronounced that out loud before. And had a huarache, which I would describe as sort of like actual Mexican pizza, as opposed to like the Mexican pizza that you get at Taco Bell
Mexican,
which is
pizza.
I've heard not authentic.
Uh-huh.
So it's masa dough that's in like basically like the dough on your pizza, covered with meat, lettuce, sour cream. And then they had slices of avocado on the top. And I think the play here is to like cut it up and eat it. At least this is how I attacked it, because it was too big to like, and it's not cut into slices, so it's too big to actually like pick up the whole thing and eat it. But basically like ends up again being kind of like Mexican style pizza. And it was pretty solid, but the downside was because of the fact that there's not like cheese melted on it like there is on pizza, the toppings tended to fall off.
Huh.
It was kind of difficult to eat from that standpoint.
It looked really good.
It was pretty solid.
Okay, what else did you have at this place?
The other thing I had there is for the first time in my life.
Wow.
I had either a tamal or a tamale, depending on your interpretation.
Wow. You could call them something else?
The debate over what's the singular of tamales, since I only had one.
It's a tamale.
I think technically it should be tamal, but both of them are acceptable as far as I can tell on the internet.
So people call them tamales?
No, then you would be, as if they're plural, they would be tamales. If you just have one, it's a tamal.
Okay.
So I'd never had one before.
Nobody has ever said I had my first tamal. You would have no idea what they were talking about.
This is all very fair. I understand it. I'm just trying to be culturally authentic here.
I don't think you are.
I am.
Okay.
So can I explain to you part of why I've never had any tamales?
Why?
I kind of thought that you ate the whole thing.
Oh,
I didn't
wow.
understand the unwrapping.
You didn't know? Did you do it on this one?
No. Did
somebody show you?
I figured it out at some point here. When I was investigating whether it's the singular of this, like, I also learned
YouTube videos how to eat a tamale. Sorry, how to eat a tamal.
And it turns out they're great. I don't know why I wasn't eating them all along. There was a real loss in my life for these past now 36 years.
Yeah, tamales are good. You know, a lot of people have discovered that before age 36.
It's embarrassing. Look, I have nothing. Look.
Most people also know to call them tamale instead of tamales before age 36. So the tamale was great.
Yeah. So I think that was a very highly rated food cart, and they've also opened a physical location nearby in downtown Portland,
brick and mortar.
Yeah, but it would have been too difficult to wait, so I didn't go there.
Look, if you can go to a truck versus a physical location, why would you never not go to the truck?
All right. So the other place I went for the first time in Portland,
oh God,
is a place that the famous Cousin Katie had raved to us about in the past, and that's Grasa. Which is a pasta place that is part of, there's a complex with like three places that are owned by the same people. You have Lardo,
yes,
best sandwiches in Portland, Grasa, and then a bar called Bureau Clock, which, by the way, I hate that expression.
Beer o'clock.
So I may not like that place strictly because I hate that expression.
Okay.
Anyways, the famous Cousin Katie had said in the past that she would like to just live at these three locations.
Yeah, you do a vacation to Portland. You go for, like, let's say you start your day at lunch, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not technically part of the complex, but also next door to all of this is Blue Star Donuts if you want to do breakfast there.
Oh, wow.
The one block. It just covers you the whole day.
Where is this block?
I think that's 12th and Washington.
Are there multiple Blue Star Donuts?
There are multiple Blue Star Donuts. And multiple Lardos. This was actually not the Lardo I went to this time. I went to one on the east side of the river.
But so you start
only the
day.
One Grasa.
Let's say you start with lunch, I think. I think your first meal would be Grasa, right?
No, Lardo for lunch.
Lardo for lunch.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to do sandwiches for lunch.
So you do Lardo for lunch.
Yes.
And then since you've eaten at a place called Lardo, you want to go and drink beer for a few hours. You go and drink beer for a couple hours, work up an appetite, and go to Grasa for dinner. And then maybe you go and drink more after that. And that's your day.
Yeah. There you go. So anyway, it had not been. I should try to figure, let's see, I don't know if I put on Instagram the name of what I had at Grasa, because I just, like, you know, I said it was my first time. It's weird for a pasta restaurant. It's not like a full-on sit-down pasta restaurant. It's like you order and then get the food, which is a little
is it,
different.
It's like Il Corvo, as far as I understand. Do they do a pasta of the day?
Well, I've never been to Il Corvo, so I can't really speak on that. That another great shortcoming of my life, along with not eating tamales. I think they have specials of the day. I mean, it's not is the menu at Il Corvo is like changing every single day,
yes.
Right? It's not like that at Grasa.
You should really go there. You live in the city of Seattle.
But the weird thing is I like go out to eat more in Portland than I do in Seattle, because every time I'm in Portland, I'm not eating at home. I'm always eating out.
You should add Il Corvo to your Seattle rotation.
I should do that. I don't dispute this fact. It's a real loss. I get it. So anyways, I just asked the server there what she recommended. All right, she recommended to me the campanelli, which is chicken milanese, like breaded chicken, covered with brown butter pasta, a layer of ricotta cheese. That was pretty incredible. There was like lemon in there, which gave it a little interesting kick, and then peas. And this was one of the richest meals I ever ate, certainly. But also one of the most delicious, without question.
Have you seen this that they have at Grasa? This is the thing that always intrigues me, is the squid ink pasta. So it's like black.
Yes.
Pitch black, and then they pair it with either clams or mussels.
Right.
And it's just topped with everything. This looks like when I look at this photo, it hurts that I'm not eating it right now.
I mean, one of the disappointments is I went to Grasa by myself. Like, ideally, I think that's the kind of place you'd want to go, as we did at Lardo, and, like, split several different entrees with people so you get a chance to try multiple different things.
How many entrees is Nate Duncan eating at Lardo? How many is he polishing off on his own?
How many sandwiches?
Yeah.
I think he'd finished at least two full sandwiches.
He finished in your meal?
Yeah. I mean, I think I probably had one and a half. It's great going places with Nate Duncan, though, because of the fact that he's able to eat so much that you're going to try, like, half the menu. Figure out what you like. It's like, if you go the first time with Nate, it's perfect.
Man. Did you have a sandwich left over then? You just accounted for 3.5 sandwiches.
Well, David Locke also was there with us.
And he had a half.
Yeah, he only let him have a half.
You guys sure are eating a lot. Like, are you sure that you want to order another sandwich? And Nate's like,
lay off me, I'm starving. That's my
Nate Duncan voice.
Oh boy, this is getting off the rails.
I knew I was going to do a Nate Duncan impression on this podcast.
So the other place, there was one other place that was on my list to go to in Portland, and that was the Burmese food cart known as Burmosphere.
Okay.
So it's only open Friday through Sunday. It's only open on the weekends. And usually when I've been in Portland this year, I have been there during the week. So I've been unable to go this whole time. So finally, I have this weekend there. I know I'm going to do it. I put it off, though, until Sunday night dinner. And I drive over there, and I have this just like suspicion, this pit in my stomach that says, but what if they're closed?
Oh, man.
And I get over there, and it turns out there's a note, closed for the weekend, will be back, like due to illness or something like that.
Wow.
We'll be back next Friday.
Wow.
And it was like, no! The, you know, just fists and like, ugh. It was a tremendous sadness.
Well,
which I filled that void by going to Pock Pock, which was great.
Speaking of something that won't be back next Friday,
the Blazers, the
Portland Trail Blazers.
Yeah, they have to make it all the way for Game 7 or to the next round for me to be able to go to Burmasphere this year.
That was like an expert level transition.
It was an expert level transition. It's not looking great because my trip featured, well, it did feature a Blazers win over the Jazz in a game that I very much thought that they were going to lose, but then it featured two losses against the Pelicans. Your Blazers in trouble in the playoffs. We said this last week, but now it's really more true. You have found a way to drink sports teams in another center.
This is all my fault,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I have taken... I did this. I took the Seattle sports stink and gave it to Portland.
Yep. And not even to the Timbers. You could have at least given it to them.
No, they're winning championships. That's even part of it.
I mean, not since the Sounders have done it.
Yeah, they won championship. Really, there's not even really also, a Seattle sports stink anymore.
It's true. It's more just in the last 5 months. Since we got...
And the Mariners for the last, like, 2 decades.
Since I declared it the best week in Seattle sports history. Ever since then, all downhill. All the Seahawks are gone from the team now.
You really did ruin everything. I hadn't considered that.
Husky Munn's basketball had a good run there.
Not making the NCAA tournament.
Husky softball's doing great.
Okay, well...
Do you have...
It's been rough.
Do you have Blazers takes?
I don't feel like I've earned Blazers takes. Does that make sense?
But you've earned calling them my Blazers?
I can't talk bad about Damian Lillard. Because I feel like I haven't been there in the weeds with Damian Lillard in the same way.
You shouldn't talk bad about Damian Lillard. I mean, look, he's not had a great series so far, but he's Damian Lillard.
Mm-hmm.
He's earned the benefit of the doubt here.
That's what I'm saying. But it's like, let's say that I was a hardcore Blazers fan, and I wanted to say that Lillard time doesn't exist anymore. And I wanted to say that he's choked completely in these playoffs. No, you don't like it when people say that people choked.
I hate that, yeah.
Okay, if you want to say that Rajon Rondo has outplayed Damian Lillard in this first round, look, if I were like a more hardened Blazers fan, those might be things I would say.
So you're just saying these by saying that they're things you aren't saying?
Or that they're incapable of stopping Anthony Davis.
They actually did it. Halfway decent job on AD. He missed a couple layups, but in game 2, I mean, it was Drew Holiday that killed them.
But I would not say anything about Damian Lillard.
I mean, Damian Lillard's not their problem this series.
Who is their problem?
The problem is that the Pelicans have zero fear of Blazers not named Damian Lillard and maybe CJ McCollum.
Why don't those players hit shots then? What do you mean zero fear?
Like, they're just... Their game plan in this series is we're not going to let Dame Lillard beat us. And if Yusuf Nurkic and Al-Farouq Aminu, who did play quite well in game 2, and Evan Turner, who did not play particularly well before leaving with a toe contusion, if those guys beat us, so be it. We're willing to go down that way. And so far, those guys, even though the role players were better, Aminu was good in game 2. Mo Harkless came back and was excellent. Zach Collins gave the Blazers some good minutes playing at center, finishing the game instead of Nurkic. But still, it wasn't enough because of the fact that they couldn't stop New Orleans at the other end.
What is the Blazers' strategy defensively? Who are they going to stop?
I mean, the Blazers' strategy is more consistent over the course of the season. They believe in, we're going to stay home on shooters. We're going to keep someone around the basket as much as possible, keep size around the basket, and force you to beat us using mid-range jumpers. And so what Drew Holiday has been able to do in this series is he's been able to penetrate deeper than the Blazers would want.
Give up layups on like every single possession.
I mean, part of what's happening here is New Orleans' floor spacing is so good that it's really stretched Portland's defense to its breaking point. Because of the fact that AD is pulling Yusuf Nurkic away from the basket when Nurkic is his defender, and because of the fact that you have to stay home on Mirotic, they haven't been able to do a good job of helping off Rondo. I think that's maybe the one place they could be more aggressive.
He's knocking down open threes to win the game.
It's open three. What's the singular of threes? It's just three. So, I mean, the other thing that's happened here, in game 1, the Blazers shot unsustainably poorly. In game 2, the Blazers regressed to the mean in terms of their shooting, and in terms of their 3-point shooting, which is random. And then the Pelicans shot probably unsustainably well. I mean, that shot Mirotić hit at the end of the game to give them the
lead. Oh, my God.
That's one of the most difficult shots I've ever seen someone make it.
Where he's defended deep. It was a deep three. I mean, when he hit that shot, I was just like, the game's over.
It was a rainbow.
The Blazers are not hitting this. I mean, it was. I think it was right after Mo Harkless knocked in the
Blazers the
three
lead.
That bounced in.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching that entire sequence thinking to myself, the Blazers are going to pull this game out.
Me too.
And then Mirotić hit that three, and all of a sudden it was like, this game's over. They're not winning when Mirotić is hitting shots like that.
And then
you miss a couple shots and it's over. Boom, it's gone.
They missed a lot of shots and also gave up four offensive rebounds without grabbing a single defensive rebound in the last couple minutes, which was an issue with finishing with Zach Collins instead of Jusuf Nurkić. But, you know.
How much of this is luck, though? How much of these two wins is luck? Because, I mean, really, the Blazers shot very badly but still had a chance to win game one.
I mean, I think the fair outcome. The Pelicans certainly played well enough to win one of these two games on the road. For them to have won both of them is a bit fortunate. I mean, and this would be a totally different series if you were going to New Orleans 1-1 as opposed to down 2-0. And so I have a story on ESPN Wednesday, or Thursday rather, updating all the series through two games and point out the crucial nature of this Game 3 for the Blazers, because of teams that are the higher
because
seed.
Because of no shit, they're down 2-0. Obviously, Game 3 is crucial. But okay, no. Let's hear statistically why it matters.
Of teams that have gone down 3-0 as the higher seed and played Game 4 on the road, that's happened 10 times in best-of-seven series since 1984, 8 of them have been swept.
Wow.
So.
I mean, if they lose Game 3, the series is over.
Yes.
It hinges on that one game.
Yep.
Because then you give the Pelicans two more cracks at home to win one game, and the two more, like...
No team has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit.
In the playoffs?
Yeah.
Just 3-1?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
No team has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit?
The Blazers are one of the few teams that even forced a Game 7 in that situation. They did it in the first round back in 2003, the first year it went to best of seven.
Wow. Well, so. You know, we're rewriting history a lot these last couple years. Improbable things are happening. But also, the Blazers are going to win Game 3.
Okay.
I just...
You're confident in your Blazers?
I feel like they are unlucky in these two games.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of them being unlucky is being explained by strategy, because that's what you do. Both you and one does. People explain luck as strategy or mismatches or whatever.
I mean, I did ask a friend of mine earlier today. Let me see if I can pull up the quote here. What percentage of game-to-game analysis in the playoffs is people looking for explanations for shooting variance? And his reply was, yes.
Thanks, Nate Duncan.
It was not Nate Duncan.
Yes.
he has a very deep voice.
It's not that deep.
But that doesn't mean that the luck is going to regress to the mean here. It's a one-game sample that's really going to matter for the Blazers.
Yes.
So
you might run of time for things to regress to the mean.
Yes.
That's what can happen in the playoffs.
They're not going to play the Pelicans 80 times. I just
that would be an incredible series, though, if they had only taken a 2-0 lead in the best of 81.
I just don't know if I'm convinced that this is a matchup that the Blazers can't win, or what the matchup is that is a good matchup for the Blazers.
Yes. I agree with both of those takes.
So maybe the Blazers are just not that good.
Been saying it for a long time.
You really are. In anything that I like. but let's just be honest here about... And even this kind of got spoiled in game two, because all of a sudden, you know, my attentions were being drawn. I was like the meme of the person who was looking at the other girl.
Okay. Unfaithful boyfriend.
And the girl on my right... was Lillard time, but I was turning my head backwards and trusting the process.
Wow, you're that in on the Sixers.
I mean, a team, the Blazers don't have any Huskies on their team.
It's true. No Huskies saw playing time for Philly in the second half of game two either, if we're to be technical here.
And they lost in the game that they lost.
It is true.
The game that they won easily in game one. And so we're reading these stories about how important, from I believe ESPN.com, it was
Mike Schmitz.
Mike Schmitz wrote a story about how important Markel was to this playoff run for the Sixers. And then they come out and just destroy Miami in game one. They look amazing. And you're saying this is going to be a sweep. They're going to the finals 12-0.
They also benefited from some bad luck in terms of shooting an opponent shooting in game two.
Although they benefited?
We're on the wrong end, I should say.
Yes.
They benefited from in game one where they shot unsustainably well in that one. So it kind of evened out a little bit. But I think Philly is going to win this series.
Philly's going to be fine.
Especially, I mean, Joel Embiid even if he's not back for game three, we'll be back at some point before too long.
Okay, and the third thing we're paying attention to in the playoffs, which is probably the most important thing here, being not the Thunder. And in this case, it's the Utah Jazz.
A big win for the Jazz on the road on Wednesday night to even the series at one. And now they have home court advantage in that series and have a chance, if they can win twice at home in Salt Lake City, to really take control of this matchup, which I think is probably the closest of the first round series.
And was Oklahoma City a little bit lucky in game one to win that game? Look, every team is lucky in every situation to win a game, unless they're the Rockets or something.
Right. I don't think they were hugely lucky in that one. It wasn't as notable as it has been, you know, in the New Orleans-Portland series.
What happened in game two?
The Jazz played much better defensively. Not necessarily...
Who told you that that might happen?
You have been more optimistic about the Jazz's chances in this series than I have.
We had a very long fight about this.
We really did. Yeah, it's interesting because it didn't happen over all 48 minutes. There were stretches where Oklahoma City really dominated this game, but those stretches did not include the fourth quarter when Carmelo Anthony, Paul George, and Russell Westbrook shot a combined 0-for-14 from the field. And the Jazz got enough scoring from Donovan Mitchell to pull this one out.
And so Donovan Mitchell looks healthy.
Yeah. I mean, he struggled a little bit early on in the game, but in the fourth, he was the best player on the court.
Once he got comfortable. And now they'll have more days off for him to play. I mean, the nightmare scenario was the Thunder won game one, plus Donovan Mitchell was hurt, and then boom, the series is over.
Yes. Could have ended in a hurry.
But he played, the Jazz played defense good, and now they're going back to Utah, even in that series, with a chance to just win out at home and win the series.
Yeah, I mean, I think it still looks like a really close matchup. I mean, it's certainly a six-game series at the earliest. You know, I think if the Jazz win, it would probably be in six, because it's so much harder to win game seven on the road. But, you know, we'll see. And there's a long ways to go in this one.
Any other takeaways from the first couple of games in the first round?
Not that we need to go into here, I don't think.
Okay.
Should we talk about Seattle sports?
It's been very much a Portland cast.
It has. And a food cast. Let's start with an update on the arena situation, the arena process, notably on the NHL side. Last week, Todd Lewicki was officially named the CEO of Seattle Hockey Partners and the NHL team president. The latest sign that Seattle will, in fact, be securing an NHL expansion team at some point before too long, expected in June. Because you probably don't name an NHL team president for a team that does not exist.
Maybe somebody should just name an NBA team president and see what happens.
Can we name ourselves? Can I name myself NBA team president?
I mean, that's what these brothers are doing, right?
Well, yeah. Maybe we need to be our own power play. So again, this is what we all expected as soon as Todd Lewicki left the NFL league office where he had been CEO, COO, I should say, comes back to Seattle where he had great success in his role with the Seahawks as their team president, and then also helping oversee the launch of the Sounders. So he's probably the most popular sports executive, like business executive in Seattle history.
In Seattle history?
Yeah, I don't know who else it would be.
Wow.
I guess maybe Bob Walsh held that role. The late Bob Walsh held that role with the Sonics before getting into event promotion. But yeah, I mean,
he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, the NHL team is in good hands here.
Okay, well that's good. I mean, he knows what he's doing, both from a standpoint of the city itself. You know, there's some concern about the group being more of an outsider group, but this is a person who understands the city of Seattle and the sports climate in the city of Seattle. Also understands hockey and understands how to unveil a team.
Right. When worked with the Tampa Bay Lightning before he went to the NFL league office, referred to it as coming home to Seattle. So yeah. You know, I don't think the lack of local ties was ever a major concern for me, but yeah, I mean, that's certainly encouraging to have that as part of this group. And then they also talked about his potential involvement in a basketball team if they can manage to successfully get one of those to play at the rebuilt Key Arena.
Interesting.
Speaking of groups trying to acquire a basketball team, the Sonics Arena group back in the news this week reiterating their desire for a street vacation from the city council and calling their offer in an insurance policy for the city in case the Oakview group, the Seattle Hockey Partners group, is unable to secure NBA in Seattle.
Interesting. So a couple of questions about this. Number one, do you feel like this message got out there? Because it felt to me a little bit like it appeared and I was like, what is this? And then it kind of disappeared quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to galvanize public opinion at this point because of the fact that there's so much focus on the Key Arena rebuild, on the hockey team, everything like that. But the most important thing is going to be getting the message out to the city council. And, you know, now there's a new leader in place in Mayor Jenny Durkin. If she believes in the two arena option, then, you know, if she can convey that message to city council, I think that's the best chance of getting the support that they need.
And, I mean, this felt like an announcement a little bit like, hey, remember us?
Yes. Which Chris Hansen previously had been at an event, a community event a couple weeks ago, and, you know, said similar things, said that, you know, they're still very much involved in the process. And I think that's a big thing, is reminding people that they haven't just given up.
They're still there.
Yeah. So we will continue to monitor that, of course.
I mean, I sure hope the city of Seattle gets a hockey team. Wonder what's going to happen.
All right, it's time for a different sound to your favorite segment. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you. Okay, so I was on Fangraphs.com earlier this week. I was excited about the Mariners' hot start. They were 9-4, I think, at that point before they lost to the Astros on Wednesday night. That wasn't super great. You know what I found, though? I went to the playoff odds section and found that the Mariners' playoff odds have gone down since the start of the season, despite the fact that they had won more than 2/3 of their games. And do you know why? I think you know why.
Shohei Ohtani.
The Angels. Yes. The fact that the Angels have played so well. So baseball has now the two wild cards. The one wild card is basically guaranteed to be the loser of the Yankees-Red Sox battle in the AL East based on the projections, although it hasn't started super great for them. The other wild card now is probably the Angels, because the Astros are still so heavily favored to win the AL West. And you know what? Where that leaves the Mariners? Out in the cold! So here's what I'm telling you. Look, it's unfair that they have to play in a division, not only with the defending World Series champion Astros, but also the new Babe Ruth in Shohei Ohtani. Never mind that poor start and blister thing he had going on the other day. Look, we need more wild cards. In basketball and hockey, 8 teams are making the playoffs in each conference out of 15. Why can't you have that many in baseball? That's what I'm proposing. 5 wild cards.
How would you do that?
Play tournament. Look, you know how sick I'm getting of seeing the damn graphic with the longest playoff droughts in major league sports and seeing the Mariners on there? It came up a lot last week because the Timberwolves finally broke the longest drought in the second longest drought in NBA history, but the longest active drought in the NBA. So the Timberwolves have done it. The Buffalo Bills have done it. And still here are the Mariners not making the playoffs. So we need to go to as many wild cards as are necessary for the Mariners.
All they need
at some point here to make the playoffs.
All they need is an offense, a defense, and some rule changes.
Do I have your support?
Of course. I'm always for more people going to the playoffs. I've told you this. I want 128 team NCAA tournament. You have my support for anything. If you told me you wanted every single team in baseball to go to the playoffs, I'd be all aboard.
Usually I'm totally against this. And this is not at all facetious.
I want to make the whole season out of the playoffs.
That's why you wanted that best of 81 series with the Pelicans.
So wait, the playoff odds have the Yankees and the Red Sox? It's kind of crazy that an 8-8 the Yankees have an 83% chance.
I mean, their projection was really good coming in.
It's just right now, preseason projection is such a huge factor here.
Yes.
And the Mariners had maybe a below average.
Like, I mean, the Angels have pretty substantially changed their outlook, I think. Like, I don't know where they started out, but they're now better than 50-50 to make the playoffs.
I mean, considering that the Mets, who are 13-4, have a lower playoff odds than the Nationals, who are 9-10.
But that's kind of the way it works in baseball. Like, everything is randomness, and eventually it will regress to the mean.
None of this matters. I mean, it's basically the same as the MLS. Like, if you could get good by July, then all of a sudden you can make the playoffs.
The MLS season is not that long in terms of games. Should we get to that now? Because guess what? A toast. I no longer have my sour beer. But a toast, because the Seattle Sounders, I think I'm good, the Seattle Sounders scored a goal.
Oh.
Not just a goal. They scored 2 of them, making regression to the mean work for them. And it looked like they were going to earn a hard-fought 3 points on the road against the West-leading Sporting Kansas City until a defensive breakdown. A gaffe. Nuhu, starting at left back in this game, fired a wild shot from long distance that was nowhere near the target. and then did not hustle back on defense, allowing Sporting Kansas City and longtime USMNT mainstay Graham Zusi to sneak up the right sideline from his right back position and fire in the equalizing goal. Sounders have to settle for 1 point on the road in a 2-2 draw.
They scored a point, though.
Yeah, the first point of the season.
I'd like to see what their playoff odds are.
Not too bad.
Wait, they're really not that bad?
Yeah.
The MLS season is way too long.
It's not that many games.
Not only did they score a goal, they also scored a point in a road game.
That's true.
Huge stuff happening here.
The weird thing is, so after we've been talking about the Sounders have been really unlucky in terms of expected goals all season, this time it flipped. They actually trailed Sporting Kansas City pretty considerably in expected goals, at least the 538 version, 2.7 to 1.6 based on shots, and then 1.4 to 0.8 based on the other aspects of soccer play, the non-shot aspects. So they were considerably lucky to get two goals out of this match.
So you're saying they should try to do badly in expected goals?
Yes. That should be the strategy.
As a statistician.
Yes.
You're proposing that as a strategy. I like it.
Yeah. I think that's the way to go. So the Sounders played this match. I think this happened after we podcasted last week. In fact, I'm certain it did. Clint Dempsey missed a second match after his red card suspension was extended to a second game due to violent conduct.
Wait, they can do that?
Yeah. I mean, they can do pretty much whatever they want in the MLS. But yes. The Sounders were also without Kelvin Leerdam due to his red card suspension. They played without Waylon Francis, the other option besides Nuhu at left back due to a strained hamstring, which if Waylon Francis were healthy, I don't think Nuhu would be seeing the pitch for a little while after this mistake, because Brian Schmetzer was really upset about it and said the Sounders should have gotten 3 points. Victor Rodriguez, who's working his way back from a knee sprain, Harry Shipp, who has a sprained ankle, and Kim Keehee. But in better news, Osvaldo Alonso played for the first time since, I think, the late 2017 regular season. He missed the entire run to last year's MLS Cup. And like the minute Osvaldo Alonso came in, the Sounders immediately started playing better.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Like, you could tell the difference.
He changes everything.
Yeah. Like, he's still really good. Even at his advanced age. He can't stay healthy, but he's still really good.
Well, on their quest this weekend for a win?
Yes, this weekend they will be hosting Minnesota United, again playing on ESPN on Sunday afternoon. Minnesota comes in rated the second worst MLS team by 538 Soccer Power Index, has a league worst 2.1 defensive rating, having surrendered 2 goals per game, including 3 last week in a loss at Portland, which is weird that you would have to play Portland and Seattle in back-to-back weeks, but not like so that you could actually do it as a road trip.
You think they're flying back?
Yeah.
You don't think they're staying in Portland like you did?
I doubt it.
Man. Their food podcast is going to be good.
This is their 5th road match in 7 games, having gone 1-3 so far in those road games. Also in soccer news, the Seattle Reign back in action after an extended stretch off. I think more than 3 weeks without a match. They beat Sky Blue FC 1-0 in New Jersey Rainstorm on Saturday with the lone goal coming on a Megan Rapinoe penalty, but lost 1-0 Wednesday at the North Carolina Courage.
The North Carolina Courage are good.
Last Thursday was the WNBA draft. I don't know if you caught that.
I did.
And the Seattle Storm drafted UCLA point guard Jordan Canada with the 5th overall pick. She's the latest potential successor, heir apparent to Sue Bird after last year's second round pick, Alexis Peterson, who was waived after this
pick 9.
Draft pick.
Nothing. That's a joke about how few picks there are in the WNBA no, draft.
More than that. It's like 14. She ended up getting waived after they drafted Canada, but did not really work out for her, and maybe not as much of a fit for what Dan Hughes, the new head coach, is trying to do. But Canada joined Gary Payton as the second player in Pac-12 history, men's or women's, with 1,800 career points and 700 assists. She is the Pac-12's all-time assist leader, was the conference defensive player of the year, is a senior, so comes in, I think, very ready to contribute as a backup point guard and to learn from Sue Bird and possibly give the Storm a long-term option at that position.
Okay.
In the third round, the Storm also drafted West Virginia forward Tiana Muldrow. But the big news of the past week
for you,
for me, and at least one listener, is that the Storm has signed Mount Rainier High School product and Stanford product Brittany McPhee to a training camp contract.
God, you Mount Rainier people would go to Stanford.
I mean, yeah.
If she would have been from Tai High School, it would have been Tai High School and Highland Community College product.
McPhee was Stanford's leading scorer as a senior, developed into an outstanding player. She'll have an uphill battle, I think, to make the roster, but cool to see her stick around, come back home for training camp. And shouts to MR. All right, speaking of UW sports, the big news of the past week...
When were we speaking of UW sports? You were talking about Stanford again.
Well, that's where I went after Matt Rainier. I didn't go Matt Rainier to Stanford. I went Matt Rainier to UW. So speaking of UW sports...
I want to hear a lot more Brian Scalabrine talking here.
You start following the Celtics. They announced last week a 10-year, $120 million-plus apparel deal with Adidas, switching their deal after spending an extended period with Nike. Do you have thoughts?
I feel like you have a lot more thoughts about this than I have. My thoughts are generally positive.
Yeah, I don't think Adidas does good stuff. Gotta be honest with you. I think Nike has a way better sense of style. I was very excited when the NBA and WNBA switched over from Adidas to Nike.
I guess there are a couple of different ways to look at this, right? Way number one is how it'll affect the program. And to me, the amount of money that they're getting shows like a real commitment to UW being a top-tier NCAA program.
Absolutely. We were kind of debating whether UW deserved as much money as they got from Adidas.
But this means, and it's mostly about football, right?
Yes.
This means that UW is like a top 10 program in the eyes of apparel companies.
If you ask people in the stands, they were always a top 10 program. Just waiting to reclaim their rightful throne atop the Pacific Northwest.
People in the stands who brought their own seat cushions. Exclusive. If you just pulled people who brought their own seat cushions and maybe also Softy. But the other way to look at it is how everything will affect recruiting, right? And you would probably assume that Nike is a little bit more cutting edge when it comes to jerseys and things like that. I actually believe that that does not matter.
It probably doesn't matter that much.
I think that people who have this opinion are people who
are looking for something to blame for why the team isn't doing better.
Yes. They're reducing everything about a quality of program to something like the jerseys and saying people only want to go to Oregon because of the jerseys. But you know what? Oregon didn't recruit that well. Chip Kelly's just a really good coach.
All true.
Oregon didn't have an advantage. I've got more. I've got a third point here. Hold on.
Well, I thought you didn't have takes.
I found takes.
You generated them.
Recruiting doesn't have to do with jerseys. Recruiting has to do with putting players in the NFL, and recruiting has to do with winning.
Yeah, it's probably true.
And also location and size of school, things like that.
Yes.
Those things are...
And the charisma of the coach.
UW has consistently recruited well, I think probably even before they were with Nike, and will recruit well after they're with Nike. Chris Peterson is the one who's...
I don't know who they were with before Nike. That predates my understanding.
Prime Sports.
Such a good joke. I hope someone gets it.
But Chris Peterson is doing the recruiting here. Jerseys do not do the recruiting. Chris Peterson doesn't say, you're going to look so amazing in this jersey. He's going to say, we are putting players in the NFL.
Can I raise a counterpoint here?
What's that?
I don't know if you've read any of the indictments in the basketball world. It turns out that Adidas was doing a rogue Adidas executive was doing some of the recruiting for many Adidas schools.
But so was Nike. I mean, come on. Are we saying that the...
But it is a factor, though. Like, what shoe, you know, you kind of... I don't think this happens as much in football as it does in basketball, but, like, which camps you go to and that
sort
of thing.
They don't want to uncover it as much in football as...
No, but I don't think shoe companies play as big a role because there's not
massive
summer
shoe deals. No. You probably couldn't name, like, any NFL athlete's shoe deal.
Yes, that is true. But also, there's not, like, summer camps done by Nike and Adidas. That's a basketball thing, not a football thing. So I don't think it's...
How much money did you see exchanging hands last weekend? How many doors did you open that you shouldn't have opened, that you shut immediately? But the third point is, the third way to look at it is the actual clothes that we would buy as Husky fans.
Yes.
They're probably going to be worse.
Yeah.
Nike probably has better clothes. But also, whatever. If the team is really good and the investment in the team, I don't know if it's going to be a factor. Chris Peterson is more important than this deal.
Yes. Oh, obviously. It's not a big deal. And the other take that we haven't mentioned from the people bringing the seat cushions is, why should the Huskies be with Nike? Nike loves Oregon. So they're probably excited about this deal from that standpoint.
There you go. Four great points. Yeah. But the point is about the clothes. Like, look, first off, you probably own a lot of Husky clothes already. You could still wear those.
That is
second
true.
Off, and you should be wearing throwback clothes to like the 90s logo anyway.
Also, was Nike responsible at all for the weasel? Because the weasel remains one of the worst things in Husky Athletics history.
Let's blame them for it. It was them trying to sabotage the Huskies because they loved Orient.
Exactly.
I don't see how this can hurt.
All right, in non-apparel Husky sports news, we start with a new addition to the rundown. We're going to talk about Husky baseball.
Wow.
Because we're also a baseball school. After taking two of three. After taking two of three from Oregon last weekend, Husky baseball improved to 8-4 in Pac-12 play, third in the conference, after starting the season 9-11 in non-conference play. I have not yet adequately figured out what happened there. They will be at Cal this weekend playing the Bears, who are 7-8 so far in Pac-12 play.
Wow, the spirit of Kevin Stocker is alive with Husky baseball.
Wow. On the softball side, they swept a doubleheader versus Cal on Sunday after some rain delays earlier in the weekend by a combined 12-2 score, and are now on an 11-game winning streak, the second longest in conference play in program history. Now, shit gets real, because the Huskies will be at number 3 UCLA this weekend, in a matchup that will almost certainly, well, probably determine who wins the Pac-12 softball regular season title. I know I say ridiculous. There's no tournament. The Huskies at 12-2 are a half game ahead of 12-3 UCLA. So, you know, if you take 2 out of 3, you've suddenly got a pretty commanding lead with a couple weekends left in the softball season. So that's a big one.
Wow. Monster softball series this weekend.
On the men's basketball front, Ryan Clark of the News Tribune was the first to report that Bitemba Baruti has been granted his release and will transfer. He becomes the fourth transfer from the initial 2017-18 roster, joining Michael Carter, Devonir DeRusu, and Carlos Johnson, who we learned earlier this week will be playing for Dan Marley.
Grand Canyon. Yeah. I like it. I like that.
School that's on the come up. So, a good landing spot, hopefully, for Carlos Johnson. This now gives the Huskies one open scholarship, even after Brian Penn Johnson signed his letter of intent last week. And it looks like that scholarship, we thought it might be earmarked for Ed Chang, but he announced earlier this week on Twitter that he has reopened his recruiting process and is no longer committed to UW, although he will consider them along with other schools.
Tell me about Ed Chang.
So, he's a Nebraska native who moved here with the intent of playing at Garfield before coming to UW, was never cleared to play at Garfield, so didn't play at all last season. He's a wing with size, basically.
Is he good? Are we sad about losing him, or do we not care?
It's not a huge deal. I mean, I think he was a more important recruit when, you know, the rest of this recruiting class had not yet taken shape, I would say.
Is he opening up his recruiting to look at schools that are similar to UW, or is he going to be looking more in like the West Coast Conference type of world?
I would be surprised by that. I mean, the big question was whether he was going to be academically eligible or whether he was going to have to defer his enrollment.
Because I've seen him listed as like a 3-star recruit.
Yeah. You know, which is like 3-star is Pac-12 caliber?
I mean, it's fine, but this is not like a program-changing recruit.
No. No, I wouldn't say that.
So what do we think will happen with this open slot, assuming it's not going to be Ed Chang? I mean,
I don't know.
Mike Hopkins did a pretty good job of doing late recruiting last year.
Yeah. I mean, that was a somewhat unusual circumstance, but, you know, if you do keep that open scholarship, it gives you a lot of flexibility.
I mean, Naz Carter was one of the players that he brought in very late.
Hamir Wright, Naz Carter and Hamir Wright, both of whom figure to be big parts of the future going forward, big parts of the team going forward. And then Hamir Wright was reclassifying to, you know, he was originally going to be a 2018 recruit and then reclassified to 2017. So, you know, that's one of the potential options if you keep that scholarship open.
Yeah. I mean, and look, we like Mike Hopkins having the opportunity to do something.
Yeah, of course. All right, lastly, on the Husky football front, this Saturday will be the spring preview and the completion of spring practice. Transfer Jacob Eason met with Seattle media for the first time earlier this week and said his decision to transfer here was, quote, pretty easy, honestly. And he cited growing up a Husky fan, the ability to play in front of family and friends, and his familiarity with the coaching staff is
wow. Reasons. You know what's so amazing? Because those things didn't exist the first time he could have chosen to come to UW.
They did exist, but also Jake Browning's eligibility existed more.
Okay, at that point. I know it's fine. I'm just saying it's like
the ability to play immediately did not exist back then.
He was coming in after Jake's freshman year.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so he would have been looking at like redshirting and then sitting 2 years.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yes. All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks. And
can we bring back an old favorite segment?
All right.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Yeah, I've got a grievance.
Oh, do you?
This whole offseason is the grievance. What good news have we seen coming from the Seahawks? Every single time you see something that is being reported by Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network or Adam Schefter or any person on Seahawks Twitter talking about anything, at what point do you see those things and say to yourself, aside from, of course, the DJ Fluker contract?
I was going to cite that. Oh, no.
The only good things we've seen is like a pretty good deal for Ed Dixon and the DJ Fluker contract. These are the good things that we have to hang our hat on. Or like maybe thinking from a cap standpoint that releasing Richard Sherman was a good decision. But also the grievance is the off season.
Bradley McDougald's new contract I thought was a pretty good one.
Like, not bad deals for maybe role players is what we're looking at here.
I feel just reasonably like, well about Tom Johnson and Shamar Stephen.
So before this week, of which there were a couple of stories that happened, a shocking amount of Seahawks news happened this week.
There had been nothing. I don't know if we even discussed the Seahawks last week.
We talked about Seabass. All right. To summarize the offseason a little bit, there was an incident where near the VMAC, a Seahawk fan shouted potentially racist things at Seahawks players, Nico Thorpe being one of them.
Yep, that was bad.
So that wasn't great. There was also the Seahawks trading Michael Bennett for very little cap savings, despite still being a good player on the field.
Yes.
But then also Michael Bennett was arrested.
That happened. He wasn't a Seahawk at that point, but yes.
Still, it just feels like it goes as part of the Seahawks offseason. I'm not even assigning blame here. I'm just saying everything is bad.
Yeah.
I've got another one to throw in here, which you're probably not expecting. So before we get there, we have them releasing Richard Sherman, who's maybe my favorite football player of all time.
Okay.
So that was fun. And then he signed with the 49ers. Were you aware of that?
That checks out.
Okay, so here's the wild card for you. Not only did the Seahawks decide to scout a quarterback over the offseason, they decided to scout Josh fucking Allen of all quarterbacks. It's like you couldn't have scouted Lamar Jackson or Baker Mayfield or a quarterback who was actually good. The people of the quarterbacks who piqued the Seahawks' interest and they decided to ruffle feathers with Russell's camp, it was Josh Allen. It's just like, what are you rolling your eyes here?
This is a non-story.
It's not a non-story. The story is that if they wanted to look at any quarterback, at least it could have been a good quarterback.
You have to look at everyone, good or bad.
I haven't heard about them checking out Baker Mayfield. Have you?
His pro day's a lot farther away.
A lot farther away travel-wise?
Geographically.
Were they at Sam Darnold's pro day or Josh Rosen's?
I guess not.
You know, Pete doesn't really have ties to the Southern California or USC. That's the thing.
Maybe they scouted those guys in person more. There's a million possible explanations. And like what we know about them scouting Josh Allen is like this tiny little sliver of everything there is to know about the Seahawks organization.
The point remains that they shouldn't have even bothered scouting Josh
Allen. It's a non-story.
Your mom's a non-story. Then this week comes around.
All right, so let's start with Adam Schefter reporting, long after we recorded our podcast last week, that the Seahawks had postponed a scheduled workout for Colin Kaepernick.
This is grievance number one, by the way.
When he would not say he would not kneel for anthem this season. Then we saw a variety of conflicting reports debating kind of the semantics of whether the question was specifically about kneeling or his plans for protesting and community activism, and whether he didn't have those, you know, wasn't willing to give them an answer at this point, or whether he wasn't willing to commit to not kneeling, or I don't know, but either way, it wasn't about football.
And then they canceled his trip.
Yes. Postpone.
They postpone. He'll be back later.
There's not a date for it.
Look, if the Stephen Morris thing doesn't work out, or they don't pick up Josh Allen in the draft, maybe they'll bring him back.
I got some Stephen Morris takes.
This is a second best thing that they've done this offseason besides the DJ Fluker contract.
Maybe top five.
What in the hell were they thinking? Look, first off, if you want to do this, don't let this story come out.
I mean, I don't think they were the ones who leaked it.
You think it was Kaepernick's team who leaked it?
I don't know if it was Kaepernick's team who leaked it.
Bring him in and then don't sign him. Just bringing him in doesn't mean that you have to sign him. The Seahawks massively fucked this up.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we had this conversation like 2 years ago or something? We were talking about Michael Bennett and Richard Sherman, I believe, they actually had different sides, takes on police brutality, right? They're having this conversation in public. They were Seahawks players. And we were talking about how amazing it was that we had this team that not only was the team good, but the team had like these thoughtful players who you could stand by what they said, and you really appreciated that they were willing to like go out of their way and say this. And now they won't even bring Colin Kaepernick in for a visit.
Yeah.
And really what this did is it not only colored the Colin Kaepernick visit, it also made us go back and look at the Michael Bennett trade and say, you know what? People, I believe it was Colin Coward who had this take, that the Seahawks were getting like strong voices or people who were going to talk about protest out of the locker room, and say he probably was right there.
I don't agree with that take. I think that's a bad take because Doug Baldwin is still here, and Doug Baldwin has been as outspoken on this as anyone. But you know what the difference is? That Doug Baldwin, A, is unimpeachably productive. And I don't think Michael Bennett was quite unimpeachably productive. And B, that he's not as old. I mean, he's not, I don't know that he's that much younger, but he's at a different stage in his career.
But so the equation is that you have to be really good to be a Seahawk now. You have to be really good and a long-term solution to be a Seahawk who can speak out about social issues.
No, I don't think it's necessarily that either.
What is it then? That's what you're saying.
I mean, also Dwayne Brown is someone who has been very outspoken on social issues, including the Houston, including Bob McNair and his continued putting his foot in his mouth, I guess. Let's go with that. I think that the issue is that, and this is something that Brady Henderson talked about today in the wake of the Michael Bennett telling, it was Greg Bishop of SI, that he was reading books during team meetings last year because he'd heard all of Pete Carroll's comments before, all of his stories, something similar to what Richard Sherman had said after his release. Guys who like just were kind of over it. That, I think, is the issue. Guys who were no longer like hearing Pete Carroll's message and really buying it.
But what does that have to do with Colin Kaepernick?
I mean, I think they're separate issues. I don't think that they need to be necessarily connected. I think they wanted to turn over because of the fact that Pete Carroll is used to turning players over every 4 or 5 years, and that doesn't happen in the NFL.
He's not a college coach for that long. Just really,
he was a college coach for enough, and he was a successful college coach. And that's like his template for success. He literally wrote a book about it.
He got bad at the end there, too.
it was one season.
Anyway, this everything about this story was bad for the Seahawks.
Yeah.
There was nothing about it that was good.
Especially the fact that they signed Morris and Austin Davis immediately after, and it made it look like oh, yeah, so Kaepernick's going to keep kneeling. We're going to sign Stephen Morris instead, which is super unfair to Stephen Morris. Like, it's not like they were competing for a roster spot here. It's not like they were going to have, we're only going to have two quarterbacks. It's going to be Stephen Morris and Russell Wilson. I don't know. But it's all bad. Everything is bad.
And also,
well, can I give you my Stephen Morris take over here?
Okay,
fine. He's actually kind of promising if you look at his preseason stats. So he spent time on the practice squads of the Jaguars, Eagles, and Colts since matriculating from the University of Miami. He signed a futures contract with the Washington professional football team in January, but was waived last week before the Seahawks signed him. But his preseason results are pretty solid. 63% completion percentage and 7.0 yards per attempt, just 2 interceptions and 184 preseason attempts. For comparison's sake, Trevon Boykin completed just 55% of his passes for 6.8 yards per attempt with 5 interceptions and 121 pass attempts. Although obviously Boykin contributes more as a runner than Morris does.
I mean, it just feels like, I'm going back to the previous point. Here's Stephen Morris, take be damned. It just feels like this team isn't as fun to pay attention to anymore.
Obviously not. And part of that was following the Malik McDowell saga, following his untimely injury in what has been reported is an ATV accident before training camp last fall as the Seahawks' top overall pick in the second round. And now, this past week, Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network has reported that the Seahawks are expected to waive McDowell because they have not cleared him to play football, and the hope is that another team will, in fact, clear him to play.
I just really wonder who that other team would be. It feels like it'd be very strange to this other team and be like, well, the Seahawks didn't clear him, but we're fine if he has head trauma or whatever.
And that may be some agent spin on it. So
I mean, the thing is about this situation, it's not as bad as the Kaepernick situation, right? Because nobody, I don't think, I don't want to say that anybody did anything wrong here. The Seahawks process with the pick for Malik McDowell was right. He was very unlucky in the situation.
Yeah, I mean, you can't project that an off-field accident like this is going to, you know, potentially end his career before it even begins. It's an incredibly unlikely outcome.
It just sucks.
Yeah.
Everything about it sucks.
Everyone loses. Most of all, Malik McDowell. Yeah. Oh, and further news. The Seahawks began voluntary workouts this week as part of their off-season conditioning program. And as we suspected, Brock Huard of ESPN Seattle confirmed that Earl Thomas is not in attendance.
I'm starting to... I mean, this is normal, right? This is not a strange thing to happen.
It's not complete... Yeah, it's not bizarre for someone not to attend these voluntary workouts.
But I feel like I'm starting a little bit more as time passes to believe that the Seahawks actually are trying to trade Earl Thomas.
My Bayesian prior of them trying to trade Earl Thomas has gotten pretty high, or the likelihood of them trading Earl Thomas. I don't know if it's better than 50-50, but it's at least close.
I'm speechless. It really is hard because we spent so long. The Seahawks weren't, for so many years, they weren't just a good team. They were a team that we liked as people.
Yes.
That we, and there have been times, we've had a lot of good teams. The Seahawks were good in the mid-2000s for an extended period of time. I don't feel the way about those players that I did about these players.
They didn't represent something larger than football in the way that this recent run of teams did.
They were just a pretty good football team who had one very good season and lost in the Super Bowl. But like Matt Hasselbeck doesn't mean anything. Sean Alexander doesn't mean, or Shane Alexander might mean something, but he doesn't mean anything good. You know, Daryl Jackson.
Matt Hasselbeck means some things to me. His support of women's basketball was very much appreciated.
Oh, nice. Nice. I mean, I love Matt Hasselbeck, but it's not like I don't feel strongly about him as a person. He just happened to be a pretty good quarterback who played in Seattle.
Right.
But this team, for so many years, basically the entire Pete Carroll era up until this offseason, it felt like we finally had this team that is both good and is able to represent in a world that is very difficult to represent these voices, voices that we want to hear in the NFL, and was outspoken about it and was willing to be outspoken about it. And I worry, I don't think this is going to change anything for Doug Baldwin or anything for Dwayne Brown because of what you were talking about. But I worry that a lot of that is going to be lost.
I mean, to me, the big thing is, and you know, this was evident going back and editing the best of Pelton Cast along with our 100th episode, like our faith in Pete Carroll and John Schneider in 2013 was unshakable.
Yes.
And it's been shaken. I guess we're not outside of the 5-year grace period yet. We're still within that. But even within that, they have lost our faith. And I just don't have a great deal of confidence in the Seahawks direction going forward other than Russell Wilson.
I mean, I still think they'll trade down in the draft. That's something.
That's true. Yeah, that's good. They're going to trade up and draft a running back.
God, that's what I'm going to say. Right? Like, I'm going to pre-add to this list of how horrible this offseason has been to my grievances for the offseason. Drafting a running back within the first 3 rounds. I'm just adding that right now.
Okay. Well, we'll go back and edit that into the original thing after it happens.
You just know it's coming. You know what's coming next week.
So, in addition to the Seahawks taking care of a bunch of business over the past week, several players who were either restricted free agents or exclusive rights free agents re-signed. The aforementioned Austin Davis, J.D. McKissic, good to have him back in the fold, Quentin Jefferson, and then Deion Jordan. Those players signed their tenders. The Seahawks did, in fact, sign Sebastian Janikowski after bringing him in for a workout last week, about which we were somewhat ambivalent, I would say.
Yeah.
And then also signed former 49ers quarterback Dante Johnson in a bit of a trade of sorts with the 49ers.
Equal trade.
They got Richard Sherman. Seahawks got Dante Johnson, who was rated, having started all 16 games for the 49ers last year, the number 118 quarterback in football by Pro Football Focus's charting. He did play rate better in a limited role in previous seasons. Has good size at 6'2", but relatively short arms, only 31.5 inches. That's definitely on the small side for a Seahawks cornerback. They prefer to have players with 32-inch arms or longer. That's generally one of their criteria. He just got a $350,000 guarantee in terms of his signing bonus and can make up to $1.3 million on his one-year deal.
And this is still like the fourth best signing of the offseason.
That's like 7th or 8th. I mean, outside cornerbacks do not tend to do well with the Seahawks.
Outside of re-signing their own players, right? I mean, look, DJ Fluker and Ed Dixon, amazing signings.
Let's see.
We're pretty bullish on Tom Johnson.
Yeah, I think Stephen Morris is fourth on this list.
Stephen Morris. The Stephen Morris signing was the fourth greatest moment of the Seahawks offseason.
Yeah, you just said, you said re-signing players didn't count.
Well, no, I mean, really, the best moment of the Seahawks offseason was re-signing Deion Jordan and J.D. Bickensick.
Well, I mean, those guys were on tenders, so that was a little more expected. But McDougald, I think, is high up there.
Oh, great. Great.
So look forward to the excitement next week when we preview the NFL draft and talk about which running back the Seahawks might select in the first three rounds.
See if they're going to trade up to draft Saquon Barkley.
More grievances being aired soon. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.